Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, March 3rd, 2017 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with a piece about the Urbana mayoral race called GOP Candidate Voted in Dem Primary, and He May Have Shot Himself in the Foot by Doing So, by Tom Kasich, Urbana. The Republican candidate for mayor of Urbana voted in Tuesday's Democratic Party primary and may have perjured or disqualified himself in the process. Republican mayoral candidate Rex Bradfield voted at his neighborhood polling place at Quest United Methodist Church, 2004 South Philo Road, Urbana. In signing what is called an application and affidavit to vote in the Democratic primary, Bradfield acknowledged that, "I am affiliated with the political party indicated by my ballot choice." On Thursday, Bradfield pleaded ignorance. "I asked that specific question of one of the election judges there, and he said, 'No, it's not a problem,'" Bradfield said. "Honest to God, I did not know that it was a problem." Bradfield's wife verified his story. He said the election judge, whose name he did not know, knew that he is the Republican candidate for mayor. He said, "Go ahead and take the ballot. There's no problem with it," Bradfield recounted. Champaign County Clerk Gordy Halton said that Bradfield shouldn't rely on an election judge to know the fine points of Illinois election law. "Even if they know that he's the Republican candidate for mayor, they don't know the legal ramifications of his doing what he is doing," Halton said. The county clerk said he turned over proof of Bradfield's vote to State's Attorney Julia Reitz, and added that Bradfield may have perjured himself by saying that he is a Democrat while he is running as a Republican. "We are in an odd situation," Halton said, "because the time for anyone to object to Bradfield's candidacy has passed. I don't know that this is disqualifying simply because of the timeline of how it happened," said the county clerk. "And as the election authority, my concern is perjury. My question is whether or not signing this affidavit means that he has perjured himself." Reitz said she was unsure where the investigation would lead. "This is a whole new one for us," she said. "We are frankly unsure what our role in this is. My civil law staff is looking into that. We're looking into whether this is really an issue for our office or whether this should more appropriately be initiated by Diane Marlin, the Democratic candidate for mayor, the county Republican chairman, the city of Urbana, since it was their election, or the State Board of Elections." Reitz said she and her staff are researching what law or laws Bradfield may have broken. "I don't know that it is perjury, because my first thought is that Illinois election law does allow people to switch parties," Reitz said. "I don't know that I would go so far as to call it perjury. I'm more interested in the question of whether this disqualifies him from being the Republican candidate," she said. "If you first declare yourself as a Republican candidate, I don't think you should be helping to choose your opposition." Bradfield said he had gone to the polling place in hopes of voting in a Republican primary, even though there wasn't one. "I was just in there to vote for myself, and they gave me a ballot, and what the hell, I voted for somebody," he said. "I thought, like the times before, that there would be something else on the ballot besides mayor. There was nothing. There was no other contested thing. I was not aware of that." Bradfield declined to say who he voted for. In addition to Marlin, the other candidates were Mayor Laurel Pressing and Evelyn Burnett Underwood. "I'd rather not," he said. Bradfield, who had lost two previous races for Urbana mayor, a state representative race and a Republican primary for county recorder, was matter-of-fact about the possibility that he could be disqualified. "If they take me off the ballot, well, that's life in the fast lane. But I'd sure be pissed," Bradfield said. Our next piece comes from a former UI student called Guilty Plea Planned Over Death of Newborn, But Nature of Charge Hasn't Been Announced by Mary Shank, Urbana. A former University of Illinois student charged with murder for allegedly suffocating her newborn son a year ago told the Champaign County judge Thursday in a minute-long hearing that she intends to plead guilty. But what crime Lindsay Johnson will take responsibility for on April 7th is being kept under wraps by prosecutors and defense attorneys. Authorities allege that the 20-year-old Monee woman gave birth to a son in a UI dormitory on March 13, 2016, and that she caused his death by holding her hand or a towel over his mouth. Prosecutors further allege that, afterward, she hid the deceased baby under her bed from police who had come to check on her in response to a call from another dormitory resident who heard what sounded like a baby crying. Johnson then allegedly put the baby in a backpack and left Bousfield Hall on South First Street in Champaign, walking around campus. She was located by police in Campustown about 8 p.m. and admitted that she had given birth about 1:30 p.m. Initially, she told police she didn't know she was pregnant until she gave birth. She also told police that the child, named Robert Johnson, was not breathing when born. Authorities awaited autopsy results before filing any criminal charges against Johnson, who was a sophomore in agricultural communications. And as they waited for those, UI police had her cell phone analyzed. They discovered that going back to September 2015, she had done online searches for information on pregnancy, miscarriage, home abortions, and how to manage the physical signs of pregnancy after the loss of a baby. Learning from forensic pathologist Dr. Shiping Bao that the baby was born alive and that there was nothing in the autopsy to explain his death, the state's attorney's office filed charges of first-degree murder, concealment of a homicide, death, and child endangerment. Johnson made her first court appearance on April 12th, a day after those charges were filed. She is represented by Urbana attorneys Evan and Tony Bruno, First Assistant State's Attorney Steve Ziegler and Assistant State's Attorney Toby Ortega are prosecuting the case. None of the attorneys would say what offer prosecutors have made to Johnson, but in court Thursday they informed Judge Tom DeFantis that they needed a date about a month away for the guilty plea. They did not ask for an extended amount of time on DeFantis' schedule, indicating that they have likely reached an agreement on what her sentence should be. Otherwise, they would have told the judge that it was an open plea, meaning he would be asked to decide her sentence. Given the nature of plea bargaining, her lack of any criminal record, and the totality of the circumstances surrounding the offense, it's likely that she will plead guilty to something less serious than first-degree murder. First-degree murder carries a mandatory prison term of 20 to 60 years to be served at 100%. The other two offenses she's charged with are both Class 3 felonies. Concealment of a homicidal death carries penalties ranging from probation to 2 to 5 years in prison, while child endangerment carries penalties ranging from probation to 2 to 10 years in prison. Johnson has been free on bond since April 12th, the day she was arraigned on the felonies. She posted $75,000 cash to remain free. Her parents have been with her in court repeatedly. Thursday's appearance was her 9th trip to the courthouse in the past year. Champaign County Coroner Dwayne Northrup said that the cause of the baby's death was smothering and that he ruled it a homicide. And next, a piece about weather statistics. It was CU's Warmest February on Record by Tom Kasich, Champaign. February, locally, was the warmest in 129 years of Champaign-Urbana weather record-keeping and the 3-month meteorological winter tied for 13th warmest. The data comes from the Illinois State Water Survey, which also reported that February was the 16th out of the last 18 months with above-average temperatures. The average temperature in February was 40.8 degrees, nearly 12 degrees above the normal month-long median of 29. Last month saw three daily record highs set. Daily highs set 70 degrees on February 17th, 18th, and 22, and two other occasions when the record high was tied, 68 on February 19th and 71 on February 20th. Overall, temperatures were above average on 21 of 28 days in February, three times by as much as 26 degrees. The coldest reading all month was 9 degrees. The coldest reading for the meteorological winter, December through February, was minus 4 on December 19th. There were only four sub-zero readings all winter. This season's average winter temperature was 33.3 degrees, a tie for 13th warmest with last winter in local weather history. The warmest local winter was 1931 through 32, when the average temperature was 37.6. Three of the 14 warmest winters have come in the last 6 years. The winter of 2016-17 will be known for its shortage of snowfall. Only 6.1 inches of snow fell during the 3 months, tying this winter for 10th place in least amount of snow. The winter of 1972 through 73 had just 2.3 inches. Precipitation overall has been lighter than normal, with just 4.29 inches, putting the winter of 2016-17 in 25th place in local weather history. Average for the 3 months is 7.39 inches. The National Weather Service office in Lincoln reported that the entire central Illinois region had above-average temperatures and below-average precipitation for the winter. Precipitation ranged from approximately 1.50 inches in west-central Illinois to close to 5 inches in parts of east-central Illinois. Snowfall ranged from about 10 inches north of Interstate 74 to about 2 inches south of Interstate 70. These totals, the Weather Service said, were 5 to 15 inches below normal, and average temperatures in central Illinois were 4 to 8 degrees above normal, said the Weather Service. And next, from the University of Illinois, Colleges Asked to Shoulder 2% Cuts, by Julie Wirth, Urbana. As budget planning begins in earnest for fiscal 2018, with prospects for a state grand bargain still uncertain, University of Illinois departments are once again being asked to tighten their belts. As part of the annual campus planning exercise, colleges have been asked to cut an average of about 2% from their budgets, Interim Provost John Wilson said. The provost's office sent out guidelines to academic units earlier this week. Wilson declined to provide more specific numbers or the range of requested cuts. It's not just about cuts. It's also about strategy and what happens in the coming year, Wilson said, such as where departments may need to hire faculty or what programs they hope to expand. We do have a shortfall because of the state, Wilson said, and schools and colleges need to prepare reductions as well as growth strategies to ameliorate the effects of those reductions. I believe it's going to be possible in every case for the school or college to mitigate the reduction by growing strategies, Wilson said. This is the third consecutive year of budget cuts for the campus, though some have been offset by income from rising enrollment or new online programs. Over the past 2 years combined, the campus has operated with $306 million less in state funding than in normal budget times. The UI received about a quarter of its usual appropriation in fiscal 2016 and a little over half so far in fiscal 2017, which ends June 30th. It has covered part of that shortfall through spending reductions and other income, including tuition. But there's still a funding gap of about $190 million, $140 million from fiscal 2016 and $50 million from fiscal 2017. Colleges and other units have contributed some of their one-time cash resources to help cover the gap and may be asked to do so again this year, said Paul Ellinger, Vice Provost for Budget and Resource Planning. That leaves a hole of about $90 million, which the campus plans to amortize over the next decade, with about $9 million in annual cuts. Last year, academic units were asked to prepare three different scenarios with cuts of 3, 5, and 7% for fiscal 2017. The range ended up being 1.8% to 5.8%. This year, each college has been given a specific target for 2018 based on what their hiring plans and key strategies are, Ellinger said. It's a little bit different approach, he said. For 2016, most academic units cut spending by 4 to 5%. Over the next decade, the campus hopes to reduce its dependence on state funding by as much as half. Even with full funding in fiscal 2015, the UI system received only about 12% of its funding from state general revenue, i.e. tax support, though that doesn't count more than $1 billion the state pays towards pensions and health care costs. The rest of the UI's money comes from tuition and fees, private gifts, grants, and other income. And we'll turn now to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called Voting Numbers Tell the Tale. Overall voter turnout in Urbana on Tuesday was a dismal 15%, but it was substantially worse than that in four campus precincts that were the subject of a consolidation request rejected by the county board. Champaign County Clerk Gordy Halton was right, and that's really going to inflame the Democrats on the county board. Prior to the February 28th Democratic Party primary vote, Halton and board Democrats were at odds over his proposal to consolidate 8 low-turnout campus precincts in Urbana and Champaign into one located at the University of Illinois Union. Halton, a Republican, said history has shown that students just don't turn out for the municipal elections held in February and April, and it would be in the taxpayers' interest to save roughly $10,000 in election costs through consolidation. Board Democrats, led behind the scenes by State Representative Carol Ammons, expressed outrage, even though the county has consolidated the precincts in previous spring elections and the board voted unanimously earlier this year to do so again. They used their muscle to reverse the earlier vote, tax savings be damned. It was to them a civil rights issue, an effort to block a suspected effort to suppress voter turnout by Halton, and a matter of ensuring access to voting. So the roughly 5,000 registered voters in Urbana precincts 2, 3, 4, and 5 had access on Tuesday, but just 53 voters bothered to cast ballots in the three-way race for the Democratic Party's nomination for mayor in Urbana. Of the 693 registered votes in Precinct 2, just 18 people, 2.6%, voted. Mayor Laurel Pressing received 14 votes to just 4 for Alderman Diane Marlin, the election winner. Of the 1,426 registered votes in Precinct 3, just 12.84% voted. Pressing received 8 votes, Evelyn Underwood received 4, and Marlin, none. Of the 1,305 registered voters in Precinct 4, just 19, 1.46% voted. Pressing received 12 votes, Marlin 6, and Underwood 1. Of the 1,831 registered voters in Precinct 5, Just 4, 0.22%, voted. Pressing and Marlin each received 2 votes. The only thing surprising about the stunningly low turnout in those 4 precincts is that anyone would be surprised. History demonstrates conclusively that the overwhelming majority of university students don't participate in municipal elections. Why? They simply don't care because they have no pressing reason to care. To them, the University of Illinois campus is just another way station in life. They see themselves as UI students, not residents of Champaign and Urbana with a stake in local government. Further, it would be no great surprise if the UI's student population collectively didn't realize or was only vaguely aware that there was a primary election on Tuesday and is similarly oblivious to the fact that there will be a general election on April 4th. That's no secret either. Everyone familiar with local voting realities knows it. So, the question is, what got into the Democrats? Why insist on squandering $10,000 to facilitate the turnout of voters who they know won't turn out? This isn't about civil rights or voter suppression or anything else related to those issues, which would be legitimate under circumstances different than the ones in play here. The only semi-coherent argument they can make is that they were concerned over possible litigation about the proposed consolidation. That litigation was threatened, Halton said, by the head of the Democrats' county committee. None of it makes sense. But then, mindless partisanship never does. The facts, however, are beyond dispute. Taxpayers took a financial bath for no good reason. And we'll turn now to the From Our Readers section and begin with a piece written by Mark Hertzman of Champaign, called Does Davis Reject Trump's Racism? Recently, I called U.S. Representative Rodney Davis's D.C. office to express concern about his enthusiastic support for President Donald Trump's disastrous Muslim ban and the anti-Semitism lurking in the White House. I have called at least 7 more times and also visited the Champaign office. Though I have left my contact information at least 3 times, I have still not received a single word in response. The most surreal exchange came when I called the D.C. office to ask how Davis would respond to the latest wave of bomb threats against Jewish centers and the desecration of the Jewish cemetery across the river in St. Louis. A staff member said he assumed that the congressman was opposed to those acts, but that he could not speak on his behalf. I asked him to clarify. Surely he could confirm unequivocally on Davis's behalf that the congressman not only opposes, but denounces those actions. No, he told me, he could not say that. I never did and still don't doubt that Davis opposes bomb threats and anti-Semitism. Less clear is whether he has the desire or will to make meaningful or to take meaningful action, not just a bromide statement, to protect all of his constituents and forcefully reject the hate and racism that chief strategist Steve Bannon and Trump have brought to the White House. That the congressman lacks the courage to even hold a town hall with his own constituents indicates that he does not. Again, that was written by Mark Hertzman of Champaign. The next piece is written by Richard Flood of Champaign, called For Sake of Ethics, Release Tax Returns. As our elected representatives in Washington, I believe Rodney Davis has a duty to demand that President Donald Trump release his tax returns, just as he would demand that an elected official from an opposing party would be. The integrity of our system rides in no small part on both sides playing by the same rules and adhering to common ethical and moral standards. President Trump was elected in part because many people felt, as a businessman, he could get things done. But he cannot serve 2 masters at the same time. He must divest himself of possible conflicts of interest and release his tax returns, just as every president has done since Richard Nixon. To not do so will very likely come back to do great damage to the Republican Party. As a loyal member of the Republican Party, Rodney Davis needs to think not just of the present, but of the future reputation of his party and its integrity. For the sake of our country, we need a strong two-party system that we can look at with pride as standing for basic principles. As the person who represents all of us in Washington, Rodney Davis needs to stand up for the best interests of all the people of Illinois and demand that President Trump and others chosen to fill important government positions must divest themselves of possible conflicts of interest. It is the right thing to do, and he would certainly demand it from people on the other side. And that was by Richard Flood of Champaign. The last from our reader's piece is written by Winston Smith of Champaign, called Taxes for Health Care, Not for War. Some say we don't have enough tax money to pay for universal health care. This is a lie. We have the tax money, but we'd rather spend it to produce an endless series of war atrocities, one of the most recent examples being the event that slaughtered American citizen Nawar al-Awlaki, known by her friends as Nora. Nora's father and teenage brother had died years ago, bombed by predator drones. Nora, however, was shot in the neck. It took Nora 2 hours to bleed out. The act that killed 8-year-old Nora took the lives of dozens more human beings, some of whom may or may not have been bad people. During this event of slaughter, we lost the life of an American soldier, William Owens. His friends knew him as Ryan. Ryan was 36 years old when he gave his life serving as a member of Joint Special Operations Command, the secret military death squad. His paycheck came from our tax dollars. His orders came directly from the president. Why, as Americans, are we not able to afford quality health care for our brothers and sisters, our sons and daughters, and our mothers and fathers? We can't afford universal health care because we are busy burying Americans like Nora and Ryan. Russia has nothing to do with any of this, and that is exactly why mainstream media so badly wants you to focus on Russia, because if you are focused on Russia, you won't be thinking about Nora, Ryan, or your aging friends and family. And that was written by Winston Smith of Champaign. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, March 3rd, 2017 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.